Nathaniel Green. We have given a rapid glance at the part which Washington took in the Revolution. He, as Commander-in-Chief, stands first, but he would have been quick to say that much of the credit for the success in that uneven struggle was due to the able generals who carried out his plans. Standing next to Washington himself as a military leader was Nathaniel Green. As you remember, the first fighting of the Revolution was in New England near Boston. Failing there, the British tried hard to get control of the Hudson River and the Middle States, as we have seen. Again, they were baffled by Washington. One course remained, and that was to gain control of the southern states. Beginning in Georgia, they captured Savannah. 2 years later, in May, 1780, they captured General Lincoln and all his force at Charleston, and in the following August, badly defeated General Gates at Camden, South Carolina, where with a new army he was now commanding in General Lincoln's place. The outlook for the Patriot cause was discouraging. One thing was certain. A skillful general must take charge of the American forces in the South, or the British would soon have everything in their own hands. Washington had great faith in General Green and did not hesitate to appoint him for this hard task. Let us see what led the Commander-in-Chief to choose this New England man for duty in a post so far away. Nathaniel Green was born in Warwick, Rhode Island, in 1742. His father, who on weekdays was a blacksmith and miller, on Sundays was a Quaker preacher. Nathaniel was trained to work at the forge and in the mill and in the fields as well. He was robust and active and, like young George Washington, a leader in outdoor sports. But with all his other activities, he was also, like young Samuel Adams, a good student of books. We like to think of these colonial boys going to school and playing at games just as boys do now, quite unaware of the great things waiting for them to do in the world. Had they known of their future, they could have prepared in no better way than by taking their faithful part in the work and honest sport of each day as it came. Green, being 10 years younger than Washington, was about 32 years old when the Boston Tea Party and those other exciting events of that time occurred. Although news did not travel so rapidly then as now, Green was soon aware that war was likely to break out at any time, and he took an active part in preparing for it. He helped to organize a company of soldiers who should be ready to fight for the American cause, and made the trip from Rhode Island to Boston to get a musket for himself. In Boston, he watched with much interest the British regulars taking their drill and brought back with him not only a musket hidden under some straw in his wagon, but also a runaway British soldier who was to drill his company. When news of the Battle of Bunker Hill passed swiftly over the country, proving that the war had actually begun, Rhode Island raised 3 regiments of troops and placed Green at their head as general. He marched at once to Boston, and when Washington arrived to take command of the American troops, it was General Green who had the honor of welcoming him in the name of the army. At this time, Green was a man of stalwart appearance, 6 feet tall, strong and vigorous in body, and with a frank, intelligent face. At once he won the friendship and confidence of Washington, who always trusted him with positions calling for courage, ability, and skill. It was not long before he was Washington's right-hand man, so you can easily see why Washington chose him in 1780 as commander of the American army in the South. When General Green reached the Carolinas, it was December, and he found the army in a pitiable condition. There was but a single blanket for the use of every 3 soldiers, and there was not enough food in camp to last 3 days. The soldiers had lost heart because of defeat. They were angry because they had not been paid, and many were sick because they had not enough to eat. They camped in rude huts made of fence rails, corn stalks, and brushwood. A weak man would have said, "What can I do with an army like this? The task is impossible. To remain here is to fail, so I will resign." But General Green said nothing of the kind. He set to work with a will, for he believed that the right was on his side. By wise planning, skillful handling of the army, and hard labor, he managed, with the forces at hand, to ward off the enemy, get food supplies, and put new spirit into his men. Soon he won the confidence and love of both officers and soldiers. A story is told that shows us the sympathy he had for his men and their faith in him. On one occasion, Green said to a barefoot sentinel, "How you must suffer from cold." Not knowing that he spoke to his general, the soldier replied, "I do not complain. I know I should have what I need if our general could get supplies." It was indeed fortunate for General Green that in this time of need, his men were so loyal to him. Among them was one who later became noted for his brilliant, daring exploits. This was Daniel Morgan, the great rifleman. You will be interested to hear of some of his thrilling experiences. When about 19 years old, Morgan began his military career as a teamster in Braddock's army, and at the time of Braddock's defeat, he did good service by bringing wounded men off the battlefield. It was about this time that he became known to Washington, who liked and trusted him. The young man was so dependable and brave that he was steadily promoted. When he was 23, he had an exciting adventure which brought him the only wound he ever received. It was during the last French war. With two other men, he was sent to carry a message to the commanding officer at Winchester. They had still about a mile to ride when a party of French and Indians who were hiding in the woods near the roadside fired upon them. Morgan's comrade fell dead instantly. He himself was so severely wounded in the neck by a musket ball that he came near fainting and believed he was going to die. But he managed to cling to his horse's neck and spurred him along the forest trail. One Indian, hoping to get Morgan's scalp, ran for a time beside the horse, but when he saw the animal was outstripping him, he gave up the chase, hurling his tomahawk with an angry yell at the fleeing man. Morgan was soon safe in the hands of friends. During the Revolution, his services were, in more than one critical situation, of great value to the American cause. In the campaign which ended with Burgoyne's defeat, for instance, his riflemen fought like heroes. General Burgoyne, after his surrender, exclaimed to Morgan, "Sir, you command the finest regiment in the world." Indeed, it was regarded at that time as the best regiment in the American army, and this was largely due to Morgan's skill in handling his men. He made them feel as if they were one family. He was always thoughtful for their health and comfort, and he appealed to their pride, but never to their fear. He was a very tall and strong man, with handsome features and a remarkable power to endure. His manner was quiet and refined, and his noble bearing indicated a high sense of honor. He was liked by his companions because he was always good-natured and ready for the most daring adventure. General Green made good use of this true patriot, and not long after taking command of the army, he sent Morgan with 900 picked men to the westward to threaten the British outposts. General Cornwallis, in command of the British army in the south, ordered Colonel Tarleton to lead a body of soldiers against Morgan. Early in the morning of January 17, 1781, after a hard night march, Tarleton, overconfident of success, attacked Morgan at Cowpens in the northern part of South Carolina. The Americans stood up bravely against the attack and won a brilliant victory. The British lost almost their entire force, including 600 prisoners. Cornwallis was bitterly disappointed, for his plan, undertaken in such confidence, had ended in a crushing defeat. However, gathering his forces together, he set out to march rapidly across country in pursuit of Morgan, hoping to overwhelm him and recapture the 600 British prisoners before he could join Greene's army. But Morgan was too wary to be caught napping, and suspecting that this would be Cornwallis's game, he retreated rapidly in a northeasterly direction toward the part of the army under Greene. Meantime, Greene had heard the glorious news of the American victory at Cowpens, and he too realized that there was great danger of Morgan's falling into the hands of Cornwallis. To prevent this, and at the same time draw Cornwallis far away from his supplies at Wilmington, he decided to go to Morgan's relief. sending his army by an easier roundabout route, he himself, with a small guard, rode swiftly a distance of 150 miles across the rough country and joined Morgan on the last day of January. Morgan was cleverly retreating, with Cornwallis in hot pursuit. For 10 days the race for life continued, with the chances in favor of Cornwallis, for his army was larger, besides being trained and disciplined. This was a famous retreat. It covered a distance of 200 miles through the Carolinas, across three rivers whose waters, swollen by recent rains, rose rapidly after the Americans had crossed and checked the British in their pursuit. When the last river, the Dan, was forded, the chase was so close that the rear of the retreating army had a skirmish with the van of the pursuers. Yet Greene was so alert and skillful that he escaped every danger and saved his army. In this trying campaign, valuable aid was given by partisans in the South. These were private companies, not part of the regular army. Such companies had been formed in the South by both sides, and that is why they were called partisans. Finally, the Southern army saw the last of the English army depart from Charleston. It entered the city amidst great rejoicing, while the praises of General Greene resounded through the country and even across the Atlantic. As a soldier and a man, he is ranked above every other officer in the Revolution, excepting the great commander-in-chief. But there was still another long delay before the needy army was disbanded and Greene was free to return to his home. Even then, it was not to settle down to the comfort that he had justly earned. When the legislatures of Georgia and the Carolinas first met, after the Battle of Eutaw Springs had made it safe for them to do so, they showed how much they valued General Greene's services by voting him large sums of money and lands. These he had pledged to secure food and clothing for his army, but the greater part was swept away by the false dealing of one in whom he had trusted. With the little that was left, he settled with his family in Georgia in the spring of 1785. The next year, while walking out in the rice field, he had a sunstroke, which caused his death within a week.